Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you. My name is Renzo del Castillo, and I am joined, as always, by...
Scott Raven, S-C-O-T-T-T, Raven, like the bird. My mother's maiden name, Raven.
And we are here for Real Poets on the first of what I hope is many episodes titled The Refrain.
And Refrain.
It's not really a repeat. We just had so many thoughts on Dead Poets Society that we kept talking about it afterwards, and we thought... it might be more productive to actually focus those discussions and have them here with you guys. So
that's right. We are going to reframe the mainframe in the refrain.
Regarding Dead Poets Society, one of the things I was thinking about is if Keating was teaching now, what poets would he be teaching us about? You know, we had Whitman, right? We had Thoreau. A prior generation to the people, along with Shakespeare, along with the classics. Who would Keating be teaching his students about today? What do you think, Scott?
Well, yeah, it's I guess important to look at what poets today capture the national or the international even consciousness. Whether or not the poets in the film did, you know, they were known, I guess, among poets. They were known among the art world, but did their influence cross over into kind of the mainstream or into synonymous with poet? What name would come synonymous with poet? And if we're to look at that today, some of the, you know, names that... who are your favorite poets? Or ask somebody that's not into poetry, just name three poets. They're still going to go to Shakespeare, Seuss, Walt Whitman. If we were to bring it up to more modern voices, let's go with the Billy Connollys. For me, the Saul Williams, bringing you know, kind of the performance poetry. There's this guy, Paul Beattie, that I really, really love some of his work of. The modern poet, you got Taylor Molly, you got the Renzo del Castillo, you got the, the mayhem poets, you know, and I say it, and not to, you know, toot our own horns per se, but the word poet, who pops into their mind when you just say poet? Is that what you want? Do you want the non poetry public, who they think of, or other poets? So poets among poets, some of the people that I mentioned, poets among non-poets, we would probably, look to some of the comics, I'd say, even of today, some of the stand-ups that have kind of crossed over into the poetry world. You know, I mean, I think of Neil Brennan, you know, I always mentioned that thing, Three Mics, that he did that had kind of elements of comedy, poetry, and...
That was a fantastic hour of stand-up.
Yeah, it's loved it.
Incredibly nuanced.
And something that, you know, I take really to heart of art, poetry, to include all of those art forms. So I threw a couple names out there, you know, Billy Connolly, Taylor Molly, people that I kind of grew up within the, you know, kind of spoken word scene a little bit. I could, you know... name so many names attached to that time, but let me hear from you. Yeah, let me throw that question back to you. Who would be taught in the class? Are we excluding the ones that are already in there? Or
I don't know. I don't know if we'd be excluding them. So I think in addition to, if I think about what modern poets Keating would assign. I see him as somebody who's rebellious, who wants to challenge what the status quo is, wants to challenge the machine. I could see him putting somebody like Rupi Kaur in the rotation because she's a modern poet. Her style, I think, is tailored to the modern mechanisms of delivery, which is like Twitter an Instagram, you know, shorter bites of poetry. She's incredibly successful. I think that he might deconstruct some of that. I would also think he would do some William Carlos Williams or E. Cummings in terms of how to play with meter and how to deconstruct it. I think a lot of what I'm thinking about now is, you know, he taught us about these classicists, and now he would teach us about people that are deconstructing what they built, right? To emphasize a point. I definitely think he would teach my holy trinity, well, my favorites, right? Like Neruda, I think in terms of dialectical realism and moving, having many lives as a poet from surrealist to writing the odes to a sock, right? You'd teach him Bukowski. Just, I think he would teach Bukowski. And I also think he would teach Szymborska.
Right.
Those are names that I, and obviously Scott Raven.
Scott,
that's what I'm thinking.
Where would he be teaching this as well? If it's still at like an all boys prep school, all right, you know, are those appropriate voices for dissection and for looking at? Now, there was a movement, you know, for a while that, all right, these old dead white guys didn't have the connective tissue anymore. It's not really speaking as much to the collective consciousness. So, you know, you want to bring on some, obviously, you know, multicultural voices that are sharing their experience, that these kids are also learning from. So that, you know, that leads, you know, like there's the Amanda Gormans, you know, the Brendan Leake, winner of America's Got Talent.
You go back to Maya Angelou as well, right?
Like Maya Angelou, these poet laureates, you know, for the United States. And that brings me to, I guess, another question of what's your feelings on like the gender, the school that is only one gender, an all girls, you know, Catholic school or a all boys prep school? Should that dictate what is being taught in a school? And some still do exist today. Yeah, I don't know if you had any feelings on that, because as Mayhem Poets, we've performed a lot at these all girl prep schools. We were once hired to do a performance at this Marymount in Manhattan. I mean, it was very positive experience of seeing our men, you know, share kind of emotional things in a crowd of women. But I'm curious to what you think of kind of gender schools.
I'm against it because I think it creates this artificial environment that doesn't exist in the real world. It ill prepares men and women to deal with each other. I think in competitive situations, in situations where you're colleagues, where you have to work together, I think it's a disservice. I also think it might come, I don't know if it's a product of this education system that we have that's a legacy of the Industrial Revolution, right? Like the way that it's segmented and formatted. And we can go into that maybe another time, or I can go into it a little bit now if we need to explain that a little bit more. But the way that it's structured, with the hours that it's structured, in terms of what is being taught, it's tied to the Industrial Revolution and going off to work. But I also think it comes from like this concept of hypersexualizing children, which I'm completely against, right? Like we need to separate men and women because they can't interact, because they'll give in to their baser impulses or whatever. That's what I think.
Okay. Yeah. So I having taught at a middle school, let's say, and this is a time where hormones are raging per se, that they're first learning kind of, all right, you know, how to do with that. And I've seen the environment, I guess it be beneficial to their focus levels for some students. For some students, not having, all right, whether it's a boy teasing them, whether it's somebody that they do have such a crush on that they can't possibly concentrate on anything else but that boy. Now, the argument is that healthy or not? While somebody's developing, the thing is, yes, you do not want repression of a feeling of love or a feeling of affection that some might have. But there is something to be said for that. All right, we're going to learn and we're going to, you know, kind of study and and focus just on what we have to do. That is again at the middle school level. On the collegiate level, all right, you know, you should be at a place where you're able to handle that a little bit better. And not saying that those middle school students, some couldn't. There were some in that school that had boyfriends outside of school. All right, they had somebody, you know, all right, at the local middle school or high school, and they'd go through the day and they'd see them at the end of the day. But for the day, they were studying. There was also a large population, and I don't want to out anybody, but specifically, but that craving that connection fell for each other. Now, not to say some actually will grow up and already are lesbians, but some they're exploring what their identity might actually be. It might not be able to fully develop if they're not really exposed to that on a regular basis.
Yeah. And again, I want to preface this by saying my experience and my opinions on this are solely as a student, because I haven't been an educator. But I will tell you that I strongly believe that decisions based on fear rarely succeed. So it's like, we're afraid kids may do this, or we're afraid kids will be distracted. Well, if you're keeping them separate since elementary school, how are they going to learn how to interact and deal with these feelings? And then when they hit society, they're unable to do so. And unable to do so in an environment where they have to learn, study, perform. I mean, that's real life. That's where that comes from for me. I'm sure that there's benefits to it. I don't know what they are. I think it's always better if you know me, right? I love classicism, like forms. I'm a classicist at heart in certain respects. And I use them I don't love them because I need to follow those rules. It's how can I be creative within them? How can I be creative within parameters? And I think if you are unchallenged or unable to deal with external factors as you can and learn how to truly keep focused on what you're learning, it's a disservice to you, right? I don't think you'll reach full creativity. And then you're also losing interesting and great perspectives from members of the opposite sex, from people that, from different sexual orientations, right? I think that for me, poetry is about connection. Education is also about connection for me as well. And in order to connect, you have to deal with people that are different from you.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm a little of two minds. I still feel it being okay, just having had taught in a middle school environment, to offer another perspective. I've done some performances at Smith College, which is an all women's school. And I don't know what their mission is, but it seemed like, you know, they're forming future female leaders. And to be in a kind of, it's the same thing of like why they still have like female only gyms too, where a female might feel more safe or more secure or more self-confident in a room where they feel they can assert themselves without an oppressive or an aggressive, if it happens to be male voice. Not to say all are, but there's the chance of that. That creating can help to form future leaders, that they can develop into their own confidence and their own level. And then, all right, knowing they're going to go into the real world, what prepares them for the real world more, who knows? But you do see now more businesses that are all female owned and female operated. That wasn't before. And great, that's great. I tend to be, and I think you as well, somebody that, all right, you know, we can be equally as comfortable in, you know, like a bro setting and in maybe a, you know, in a more, you know, a whole group of females. Mm-hmm. To be able to have that conversation. I'm aware there are quite a people that they aren't. Mm-hmm. They aren't quite that way. They don't choose to. They don't want to.
And I'd also like to clarify that I'm not saying they should be done away with. I'm a very big proponent of freedom of choice. I just think that if your education is segregated in any way, I think you're at a disadvantage, which is my opinion. But I don't think we should do away with all these schools. You should have the choice. If you feel more comfortable in this type of setting versus another type of setting, by all means, you should be able to do what you want to do. But I do think that you're losing a perspective, you're losing experiences.
Right. So if we tie this to, I guess, Dead Poets Society, it being an all-male school, how much did that play a factor into kind of what happened in the film? You know, there's the extracurriculars where they do get to invite females, and that happens to happen in these schools too. All right, study time is study time, but once it's time, maybe if there's like a dance or a gathering and a party, they are welcome to come.
So tied to the movie, I think that being in an all-boys school definitely put at least Knox at a disadvantage on how to interact in a healthy way with a girl he likes at a party, right? He's like, oh, I don't know how to, this is the first time I'm seeing a girl. First of all, I'm so in love. It's the most beautiful thing I've seen. She's passed out, asleep. Let me kiss her forehead while her boyfriend's sitting over there. Maybe you would learn different social cues. In terms of the Dead Poets Society inviting two girls, I remember, right? It was Miss Charlie. Charlie invited two girls over to the cave. It seemed like a bunch of lost boys posturing and dressing up for Wendy Lady, right? It was an interesting thing, passing off other poets' work as their own in order to impress girls, right? I don't know if it has an agenda or it has an idea it's trying to promote about that separation or going to an all-boys school, but I do think that it does highlight the bonds that the boys create in order to survive an oppressive environment.
Yeah. It's interesting to see what type of poetry comes out that they're writing, being in that environment, where whether the kids, you know, would they feel inclined to share in class a poem about maybe a crush that they have or about, you know, how they feel for somebody. Oftentimes they might share that, but they might do it, you know, one-to-one, not in a school's type setting. It's great to write that, but it almost forces you, all right, I'm going to write about these, you know, kind of these other things. It happens in the poetry world where people, you know, that they write the poems to woo. I think to have these extracurricular activities that they come to, that's great. It doesn't in this movie give the females a voice, though. There is no, I don't believe, a woman in the movie that does share a poem of her own.
No, and it also has the scene where Keating famously asks the boys, what is the purpose of poetry? And they give an answer. He's like, it is to woo women. Like, I think that is a limited viewpoint, right? I think poetry has so many much more, it's to woo your loved one. Women can use poetry to woo too. I mean, we have like Emily Dickinson, Sylvia Plath. We have a rich history of female poets that we can touch on that should also be taught in the more modern class. But I do think there is a definite slant and maybe some blinders on when it comes to what the purpose of poetry is in terms of, yes, it's what we stay alive for. It's what makes life worth living. But if it's just, I know he was joking, but if it's just to women, you're missing a huge perspective there too. Because you could have like gay students wanting to use poetry to woo men. Right. I think it's a very, very narrow
view.
Well,
if we just say to woo, because that, you know, I have one of my friends always is quoted as saying, you know, how'd you get into poetry? To meet girls, right? Like to meet girls. And that's okay. Like they sure. His class was going on a trip to a poetry cafe and he invited, you know, he's like, oh, great, a free date, you know, and it was to meet girls. And then from there, he fell in love with poetry. Like, it wasn't the women. He fell in love with poetry. And that, it's okay. That was a gateway. He felt strongly maybe about the girls, about the people, but then that opened him up to, wow, I love the words. I love the images that are being created.
Do you believe poetry still holds revolutionary power today?
Yeah, I mean, my feelings on this always is that there is the king and the Malcolm X, you know, that you have the great orator that can gather people together, that can, you know, deliver filibusters for, you know, 20 plus hours. And then you have the fighters or the people that influence change through maybe some direct action. Now, I, being a pacifist, don't believe that things should, you know, things have to go that way. You know, there are people that influence from a mic, you know, and people that influence from going directly to, you know, like a physical protest. I believe that there are people that already have an audience that have the greats. They have the poets in them. They have the poets, the work of the poets that have told these stories before. And they can get that message out through their audience, whether it's in the art they create. I believe they've been influenced by the poets. They realize, all right, poets, you know, it wasn't poetry that got them their audience, but the poetry is infused in them to be revolutionary in the art that they create.
See, I struggle with this one, right? Because I try to see how it functions with resistance, with identity, with social change. And I think, you know, in the past, early 19th century, early 20th century, the diplomats used to be poets. The ambassadors used to be poets, artists. That's who we would send to their countries to build connection, build bonds, build treaties. And whenever you had a fascist regime taking over a country, like, you know, Franco in Spain, for example, or Pinochet in Chile, the first people they went and assassinated and took out were the artists. They were the poets and others, musicians, people who could garner that. I think since the early 20th century, at least in the US, I don't think we read as much as a country anymore. You can check that fact within like books sold, things that are read. I mean, there's a high culture of like reading to be cool. Like, this is what I saw Kylie Jenner reading on Instagram. So I'm going to read this book and oh my God, and all that stuff. And look, I want you to go read whichever way you get there, right? But I don't think we read, as a nation, we read as much as we used to, maybe prior to the Vietnam War. That those numbers have declined. So I don't know. I can't think of the last poet I would think of, like a modern poet who I would think is a revolutionary, right? Because while Rupi Kaur, who I mentioned before, is very successful, I don't see her as somebody who speaks truth to power in terms of a political exchange or what's happening in, you know, in current events, right? It might be revolutionary in terms of self-love. Maybe that's a way to define it. But I don't know. Maybe the distinction for me is, what do I mean by revolutionary, right? And I think I still have those connotations of resisting oppression, resisting regimes, resisting things that go against, you know, the bohemian ideals, I guess, for lack of a better term.
But that's, you know, that's what I'm saying. People are incorporating poetry into any revolutionary rhetoric. You know, a Cory Booker that does this filibuster, he's quoting poets. He's quoting his own poetic thoughts that are coming out, you know, that are going up against the man. Now, If we're talking about who has the power to really impact this type of change or who is being heard, that's kind of a different question. It's like stand-up comics at this point in life have garnered a much wider audience. You turn on a Netflix, there are, you know, probably hundreds of comedy specials that are seen by millions of people. Not all 100 are seen by millions, but they're seen by millions of people. Show me a poetry special or a poet, someone in that art that has said their art that garners that much attention to then have that much influence. So I guess a more question is, if not, why not? You know, why aren't poets regarded universally? You know, I guess there are poets that do have audiences of millions. They have the ears of, and what they say holds some water with that generation. There are hip hop artists that, all right, from the past that have influenced generations that have, you know, stood up to the man, stood up to the police, stood up to things that I tie in with poetry. I'm going to put the comics and I'm going to put the hip hop artists.
Oh, for sure.
Into the poets, the revolutionary poets, the last poets, of course, you know, still around in some incarnations that are out there. I got to say that it is still there. Logic and reason, you know, non-imaginative thought, I guess, seems to rule the country a little bit, or I don't know, that's the system with which, you know, being just even a capitalistic society, you know, wouldn't it be great if it was, you know, like an artistic society, you know, I mean, but that would probably be chaos as well, you know, people paying and people exchanging, you know, creations rather than, you know, paper money.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I deconstruct this for myself, like in this conversation with you, as I question what I'm thinking, I think my bias is like what poets won the Nobel Peace Prize or Nobel Prize for Literature, right? And I think of Neruda, I think of Szymborska, Yeats won it, Rabindranath Tagore won it, Rudyard Kipling wanted to. And I, like if you go and examine Neruda, he used poetry to help elect a socialist president in the West, the first democratically socialist president in the West, in Salvador Allende. If you think of Wisława Szymborska, somebody who documented the fallout after World War II and the growth of communism in all of these different countries around what was Poland, right, around that area, and how the landscape changed, and she documented all of that. Rudyard Kipling, all those wars, right, in India. So I'm trying to think of that, and maybe that's something I need to question, because I do consider hip hop artists poets, right? I do consider,
Comics to have
yeah,
poetic
comics, yeah. Like, I mean,
sensibilities. But
speaking of Robin Williams is somebody
of
that
course.
used comedy. That guy's brain, I think his
Oh, yeah.
drug use
He's
might have slowed it down. He
right.
operated on another level.
No.
And he was
Yeah.
highly intelligent,
The
and he.
reference bank that he's drawing from is pop culture plus its classic literature plus its history. Yeah. Like all three at the same time. And if you miss one, you might get two or three. I try to do that with a poem too sometimes, like, all right, yeah, you throw, 20 references in to something too, somebody's gonna grab a hold of that. Some poems it's just the emotional through line, but he was great. And this was a more subdued Robin Williams, as we've discussed in Dead Poets Society, apart from kind of the genie where he is a bit unhinged and it's just reference, 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 reference. Because keep in mind, yeah, if you're playing in a period piece, this being the 50s, it's tough to you, without being anachronistic, you have the reference bank that you do have. And that brings up another question too within poetry of, what pop culture references can you choose to use without either making your poem dated or only be a product of a certain time? Now, some poets strategically or instinctively don't use, it's void of reference, of allusion, or modern allusion, let's say, because of that fact. At this stage in the game, I feel anything's fair game, that things come back around, and whether one person catches the reference or a million, I mean, but your work, you don't often use pop culture references. You use human experience and maybe historical, but not as much pop culture.
But I do when it serves the purpose of the poem. So I recently wrote a poem called Oceans, which you looked over for me when I was finished. And one of the stanzas is very well grounded in Miami, and I have a call out to the emptiness of space, with space capitalized, which, if you're not familiar with Miami, you might be thinking I'm talking about outer space. But it could also be a reference to Club Space, which is a famous club in Miami, part of the Miami nightlife that has been from the 90s till today. I use these references, I think, when it serves the poem, when I'm trying to create, when I use them to attempt to create an atmosphere, a little Easter egg for the conoscenti, right? Anybody who's from Miami may somebody who's from Miami will probably recognize that reference while reading it than somebody who's not. I do use pop culture references depending on the type of poem. When you and I have collaborated, we've definitely made a lot of Jean-Claude Van Damme references in one of
Of
those things that
course.
we've done.
Which what well the example that you used, I'd call like a local reference or local color. I tend to view pop culture as in universally known, or I don't know, film and television, a connection to something within kind of film, television, radio, or books.
Oh no, fair enough. And I do use them as well. It's interesting because I have, so in this, when we're doing this podcast, we're also each of us coming up with a body of work of ekphrastic pieces on movies. I think my pop culture references are just disguised as universal observations, but because it's from that movie, and if you've seen that movie, you catch them, right? So they're there, but maybe I step away from doing it overtly unless it's part of a poem where I'm having fun with something that's of the now. But they are there, but I do, you're right. I do tend to clothe, I do tend to sneak them in as opposed to being more overt. And you are
Yeah.
definitely more overt.
Moral Vert. I mean, I try to portmanteau a couple together, blood portmanteau some a couple together. but like the question I guess is, while reading it, if it's a reference you don't get, does that take you out of the through line or the narrative of the poem, right? So like that's why I'll try to encase it maybe in a double meaning, whereas in like, all right, the sentence you get, it may be an allusion to something, but try to get the essence of the sentence, whether or not you've actually seen or are familiar with the actual work too. That takes some layering sometimes to do, but for you, if you're, you know, we'll ask you, but, and then speak maybe for another type of reader, is it going to take you out if you don't get something? Familiar with it.
I don't think so, right? Because you go back to one of my fundamental thesis I have regarding poetry, right? I don't typically like to explain my poetry because I don't want to influence your reading of it, because I think that you create your own meaning and your interpretation of my work creates a whole new work, right? A whole new thing. This is, remember, I called it, we're Pixar-ing this, right? Like when you have this reference that, you know, works for adults, works for kids, and works for fan of a certain work. And if you don't get that reference, you can enjoy it on a different level still. So I think in the context of a poem, if you structure your work effectively, you may have a reference in there that enriches the experience for, like I said, a member of the conoscenti, somebody who's familiar with this. And if you don't get it, that's fine. You can read that in a different way. Like I'm telling you, with Oceans, I specifically wanted to criticize, or the speaker of the poem, not necessarily me, but the speaker of the poem criticized like the perceived shallowness of Miami clubbing culture, right? But somebody can look at that and see it a completely different way. They don't have to do that for the overall meaning of Oceans to be distorted for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. Well, the way my mind works is in association, so much of like word association and then word association once removed. And like you say the word, even to say the word oceans for me, you know, half the people are thinking Atlantic, Pacific, Indian, and Arctic. And I'm thinking of, you know, Brad Pitt and George Clooney in a heist movie, you know, like, right. Like
or Frank, we can't forget Frank Ocean
and Frank as well, where like, that's just, all right, that's where my mind, you know, will go. It probably does have some influence over how I'm interpreting the poem, like a little bit. Like I'm holding, of course, all those in there. And yes, you know, I'll read and then, all right, this poem, yeah, it has nothing to do with that movie. It has a little bit more to do with those types of oceans and what oceans really, really mean to you. But there's something to me about the interconnectedness of language, and any usage of a word relates to every other usage of it in some way, you know, where it's all kind of standing on everybody's shoulders, or the roots, you know, they're all connected. I mean, connected through the 26 letters of the alphabet, but connected through, you know, some one or two kind of associations.
I'll give you an example. And I've shared this poem with you before. It's Wrocław Szymborka's vocabulary poem. And in that poem, just a very quick overview for the audience. It starts with, La Pologne is it terribly cold there? So there's somebody asking the poet, the speaker, a question, is it terribly cold in Poland? And then the speaker goes off into this, like my people do their writing in mittens and all of these things that pop up here. And there's icicles all over the place and this winter wonderland of beautiful imagery. And then she says, but I forgot the word for walrus in French, and I'm not sure about icicle or pickaxe. So she just says, pas du tout, a little bit, not so much, right? So on one level, when I first read it, it was this, for me, it was this beautiful commentary on how much is lost in translation. But then when I did more research, just in general, I was researching, because I'm a big fan of Polish film. Like I love, what's his name?
The trilogy, the red, blue, and white?
Or yes, and Kieslowski? The Decalogue.
Kieslowski.
I love Kieslowski, and I love like blue, blanc, and rouge, and I love the Decalogue, and I love all those movies. And I was researching the changes that occurred. There's this huge connection between Poland and France in terms of migration after World War II. It's where a lot of Polish people immigrated to Poland, and then their art also, like you had all these Polish auteurs creating art in France, and it was no longer Polish art. It was this French Polish intermixed thing. And then when I read it again, based on the time period and the year that it was written, it's like, it's also a commentary on how many different countries were popping up that didn't exist, right? So there's these layers to these poems that it was a perfectly beautiful poem for me with my interpretation of it. And then as I experienced more and I learned more and I went back to this original work, I was able to see even more nuanced layers that were there. The layers were always there. I just didn't have the eyes to see them yet. And I'm curious what I'll learn from this poem 5 years from now, 10 years from now, right?
Completely. Yeah, the eyes and the legs, I would say too. Yeah, like having, you know, having seen or having, yeah, walked, been there, experienced it in full sensory mode. This was making me think of, I'm always conscious though of those that aren't, whether we call them deep thinkers or, you know, like people are looking for, you know, whether it's instant gratification or whatever. And like, sure, if somebody were to comment on my work, you know, like it would be like, oh, you've got great wordplay, right? What great use of language and puns, right? And I feel at times somebody will see just that. Mm. That's it. Okay. And then they're like, wow, that's great. If I'm going to comment on this work, I'm going to see that. And maybe I'm not even going to, you know, get the rest of what they're actually trying to say. Now, because there's something to be said for like, you know, on a rhyme or a punchline or a pun, right? It creates almost like a little bit of a dopamine spike, you know, like in the listener. It's like, oh,
a memory.
Oh, it creates a memory. What I would hope is that you're getting all these, but you're still following the full narrative of something as well. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody wants to do that. So that was, Robin Williams too, sometimes where you would get it. It would be sometimes a series of disconnected punchlines and references, right? That like, all right, the genie, he would be able to kind of go off on a riff, but you needed the right framing device for it all to kind of make sense. And when you got to see kind of the heart behind him, that's when the stuff really, you know, really kind of connects. And I've struggled with that. Like, is being too clever not being clever at all? Or you know, like, is it too much sometimes because it takes you out of, okay, either an emotional through line? And I'm conscious of it. And there was a point in my writing life, I was like, all right, you know, I could pare down, but I wanted to become more of me and not cater to some other types of things, you know, so I prefer, I guess, to layer it rather than one note. Tell me what you think of that, other people's kind of interpretation and, you know, even your own impulses. Like, you've commented on something that you see and you're looking for connection with somebody. And sometimes that's enough. Like, people that I know got the goods, I'm going to read their shit and then I'm going to reread it. And then, like you said, I'm going to,
Right.
Right.
Well, let me use you as an example. Let's use the Spaghettisburg Address. Yes. I think that poem actually fits this conversation nicely, but I have an aversion because of who I've been in the past, the way that I grew up, being a recovering people pleaser, right? I have an aversion to making fear-based decisions. I'm not saying I'm not afraid. I face my fears. To not be afraid is, I think, to be an idiot, because you can't tell, like, you're unable to intellectually discern there's risk here, right? But you face those fears. And I have an aversion to making those fears-based decisions. And one of the biggest fears that I have is being misunderstood. Still there, right? It's much less, it drives my decisions much less than it did in the past, but it's still there. I have a feeling of being fear of being misunderstood. When you write a poem, and this is where I made my peace with it, I'm very into it. It's mine. It's me putting out like all my thoughts and feelings. It might not necessarily be literal. It could be something thematic that deals with a theme that I'm struggling with in a different way. And I put it all on paper. But once it's on paper, it's no longer mine. Copyright pending, right? But it's no longer mine. It becomes yours because now you're interpreting it, right? There's an owner. I learned to let go, and that release has helped me in my quest to be me in a ballad as well as to still be Renzo the poet in a Barzelletta, in a sonnet. I haven't tried a sonnet yet, but you know, a sonnet. So when I think about your poem, The Spaghettisburg Address, I can understand you being concerned. Like, there's a lot of wordplay there, and it's super fun, and it's super light, but it's not, right? Because you're dealing with these greater political ideas and conflict and struggle, but you basically put broccoli in my mashed potatoes, and you're like, here you go, like, here, digest this, right? And some people might just look at it at face value, but others might be like, whoa, what's he really saying about, you know, like our constitutional rights here, as an example, right? Or what's he really saying here about conflict resolution, right? I don't want to go too deep into it, because I implore all of you guys, if you haven't read this or heard this, go hear The Spaghettisburg Address. Go see it. It's in your last book, right? It is in. Can I get a plug? Can I get a cheap plug right now?
It is in Stay at Home Dad. And I'm looking to do a video of that too, of me kind of just gorging on some pasta.
I don't want to just talk. I mean, do you see what I mean in terms of like me seeing that poem? Because I'm not the writer, but I'm seeing that poem as one that could be very easily digested in terms of the wordplay and everything you mentioned. But there, I mean, I could be mistaken, and you don't have to go into it, but I do see a deeper meaning and things that you're struggling with there.
Right. There is some undertones, you know, with that one I almost like backpedaled, where like at first it was entirely just about pasta. And then like I threw pasta at the wall. Let's say I threw a thing of pasta at the wall. Then I went into it and I looked and I was like, oh wait, there's some other things that came out in my exploration of kind of merging kind of a Gettysburg Address and spaghetti together. There was things that just instinctively just came out. And I kind of found what was my personal connection a little bit to that. I looked at the event itself, like, all right, this was based on going to an Olive Garden with my son for the first time. And Olive Garden is known as, you know, where when you're here, you're treated like family. Man. And what struck me was, oh, yes, this was my family. This was me, my father, his grandfather, and Banzai. And who was missing? But the women, the matriarchs, like they were actually just not in attendance at there. And I went to say, it's like, oh, you know, like, can something really be family if like the matriarchs aren't there? Can something be homemade if it's not, you know, with your family, all fully there?
And to share with you, for me, when I read it, it was like, oh, were women even present in terms of the drafting of the Gettysburg Address, right? Like, it was, for me, it was this parallel in terms of narratives. And I mean, I hope that you get that elusive Olive Garden sponsorship soon. But
right.
Well, that's what I mean in terms of the poet. But I want to ask you a question, because I think this segues nicely into it, because I'm thinking about Todd and the moment where he has that spontaneous, not just creating and writing poetry,
yes,
but it was a poetry performance, right? He might have had his eyes closed and all that, but he was performing poetry. And the Spaghettisburg Address, I think it's great on paper, but you definitely add nuances to it when you perform. You never perform it the same way twice. So can you tell me about your first experience performing poetry out loud?
Oh, wow. Yeah. So there was two that kind of come to mind. And one either was about being very insecure, a poem, and it fit kind of, all right, what I was writing about with kind of how I was delivering it, right? It was still a little performative, but like I was able to play into that. Like, there was a poem, you know, about like being a little manic after having broken my or busted up my knee, and I got, you know, brought that out, and I was able to start to incorporate what I was really feeling into the poem. Now, let's say, you know, you're a depressive and you're performing, you know, your poems, and maybe you're writing of that. All of them are going to take that poem. Now, every time I perform something, I try to be as present as I can and try to be able to at least add some of what I'm currently experiencing. Later on in my life, now I kind of even get to the point where I'm tweaking some of the words sometimes to fit that narrative in certain poems, you know. But how can you find your way into that poem? And, you know, in Dead Poets Society, that character, yes, it's fascinating because, as we might have touched upon, he's learned it as an actor. He's memorized this piece, but he has to deliver it as if it's coming out for the first time. And I'm sure there's the character, but there's also Ethan Hawke in there.
Within the play you love to talk about, right?
Exactly. That he is experiencing with Robin Williams, like, holding his forehead in real time in that moment. holding his mouth. And that's where, like, wow, it's a great performance. They're meeting each other. Like, he's bringing a part of it out from Ethan Hawke as well. There's an element of that I really, my dad used to tell me there was a baseball player, I'm not sure who was, where he would always limp to the home plate. He would kind of like really slowly limp to home plate. He would get up, whether he got, you know, a hit or not, he would be the fastest guy around the bases, that he would just be like, whoosh, and just dart like all the way around.
That wasn't mind games. He was just 35, you know, like, or he was Yoda in Attack of the Clones. You know what I mean? Just like,
Yeah. Yeah. But I used to always think that, you know, there's kind of like the underdog mentality, and Ethan Hawke kind of, you know, sneaks up on you there where, oh, you know, this, does he have that in him, you know? And he does, if you look at it, but, you know, we almost all have that in us, you know, but will we be able to let it out? And what is the art form that will allow us to let what it is that out? For him, yeah, poetry happened to be. And for Ethan Hawke, it's acting, you know, like that is able for him to do it. For Robin Williams, you know, it becomes comedy. What is it that kind of lets out your lifeblood? What allows you to show your lifeblood? And he does it. There was a time in, you know, my early performing career where I was an exaggeration of myself.
Yeah.
Rather than myself, you know, I mean, my first poem is, you know, me turning into a chicken or whatever. And still there's time to do that. Like that hyper you, can you in your poem, you know, present that authentic self? And this is if you're writing from a I perspective and from that, can you bring the real you and what you're going through, or get yourself into, you know, this is an acting talk of like, all right, what's your way into this poem right now that you're performing?
I think you can. I think it's an act of bravery, maybe even an act of rebellion. Because I think about the first time. So I was thinking about this question for myself earlier today, which is why I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
And I must have performed poetry, you know, for my poetry workshop classes when we were presenting pieces. I know that, I mean, I did some theater as well in college. But the first time I remember performing poetry out loud in terms of like with considering myself a poet, maybe because back then I didn't really consider myself a poet, was at an open mic at Layla in Miami Beach. It was a rooftop restaurant in one of these like Lifehouse hotels. And I read A Song to Victory and the place was packed. And, you know, I start off with... you know, the poet voice, like, falling in love with you is falling in love in Spanish. And I have this delivery that's a bit low, a bit more sensual. And I read it and I'm performing the poem. I'm sitting down. I'm not really somebody who memorizes it yet. More to come on that. But then I get to the moment where I realized that the power of poetry could be translated to me and me to have power over people. I read a line that said, to build a home in the space between your collarbone and your bosom. And I saw, and I shit you not, I saw about, I remember, yeah, it was like 13 women just grab that space.
Right, right.
And I'm not saying like, oh, they were all into me or whatever, but in that moment, in that performance, I was like, and I'm like, I can make them do that. What else can I make them do? But the danger is, for a bit, I just started writing things to recreate that high. So similar poems to that. And I wasn't being me. I was being a version of me. It was like trying to hold on to a memory, right?
Right.
Instead of being the active me. And now I feel much more comfortable. I think I mentioned this to you before, which is, you know, the greatest, when I was young, I wanted to write like Neruda. I wanted to write like, Bukowski. I wanted to write like Szymborska. The greatest gift they gave me was the day I decided to stop writing like them and start writing like myself.
Right.
Because I have something valuable to say. I have something I want to share. And then when it comes to performance, when you are not being yourself, I think the audience can tell. I think you lose a little bit of the energy in the room because you're too focused on trying to please either your idea of who you are or trying to please the audience or trying to do that, which is different from winning back an audience. Like, let's say you're performing at a bar and everybody's out there drinking. I think when you're genuinely yourself and you find that, again, you maybe you're reading a poem about like toxic masculinity. Maybe you're not that, you're not the one with toxic masculinity, but you are making a statement of it and it could be real for you. And if you perform it with conviction and with authenticity, 9 times out of 10, you get that room. You've performed professionally. You perform much more than me. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
That was a great story of you trying to recreate that same emotion that, or same gesture that somebody, you know, kind of touched by something that you said. And let's say you are performing that same piece every time, mm-hmm. and you still have the picture of it being, you know, like I performed for 7,000 people a poem and it went really well. And like, oh, wow, you know, like there's certain times I've done a poem and it's like, wow, I don't think it could ever be like that.
Not to interrupt you, but you punish yourself too. I want to bring this in because I forgot to say it. And you said something that triggered it for me. I did perform that poem again. It became like a favorite at the end. And then I was upset. I'm like, only 11 women and a dude, you know, touched their collarbone. Only 8 did it. Oh, this time 16 did it. That was not good. Like, that wasn't healthy as a poet, right?
Yeah. Right. And which goes back to how can I find my way into this poem right now? And like, mm-hmm. you know, I've written a sequel to my own piece, you know, and try to revisit it. And then by writing a sequel, it adds some nuance to the first one. So I can, if I do them back to back, it makes you look at, you know, something from this perspective, but you can also kind of appreciate that. The anecdote before the poem can change. The poem now, okay, keep that as is, but like, all right, you know, there's such a history now that is attached to that piece that can make it fresh, you know, every time. That's what I like to do too. Yeah, like keep going back to that, you know, find your way into that poem. And some people are able to do it verbally with an anecdote. Some people, that's internal. Like, all right, I'm what happened to me today that makes me think a little bit about, you know, the mania or the, you know, like inquisitiveness that I was when I was writing this, you know, and that allows, you know, you to stay present with it, which harkens to memory, you know, completely as well, where like, all right, you know it back and forth, you can then not attach, but live in it. If you know it so well, you can live in it and you're not setting, I'm saying this line like this and that line like this. You can, you know, completely go in completely different directions. Because something I like to do is ride the wave of the audience too, equating it to mm-hmm. surfing, where it's just, yeah, you're hearing kind of a laughter and you're kind of like, sometimes I'll cut off their laughter because I know another bigger laugh might be coming right after it, you know?
Performance to me is another, it's an art different from just writing the poem or reciting the poem, because you're able to make a connection with the audience and then just riff or ad lib together, right? Improvise together, ebb and flow, depending on where the audience is going. And I'm happy to say that I feel like I've done that. And it's such an amazing feeling, but it's no longer like chasing a high. Now it's just like, hey, let's create new meaning together.
Right. Comics do such a great job of table setting before they even mm-hmm. start their poem. Kevin Hart in particular, you know, like, all right, reading the energy of the room, so that they are ready to receive the jokes. And if these jokes are going to be, you know, a little controversial or a little bit harsh or biting, you know, table set, get that audience within the right mindset so that they are able to receive that. So that, all right, no matter, you know, what comes, if this is something about, you know, togetherness and everything, you know, like what can you do to unify the crowd before, you know, even, you know, start, if you want them to be divided at first, you know, a little bit, you know, what can you do? Can you do that in the course of a poem too? You know, I mean, that's something as
yes.
well.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, I could definitely go into that for hours, but I want to be mindful of the time. I have three questions that I really want to ask you.
A couple others.
And then I have a lightning round that I thought would be fun. If you had to start your own Dead Poets Society, which three poets, present company excluded, which three poets, dead or living, would be in your Dead Poets Society?
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.